Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Mike and Scott in for Cherry Gregg today. And we have a really good lineup this today.
Tell us about it, Mike.
Yes. So we are going to hear about the bird flu, which a lot of people are concerned about. Scientists are concerned about. It is spreading in new and different ways. So we'll get a checkup on that. And then on to a happier topic, a contest called Eurovision.
Eurovision.
That's right.
Eurovision. You're intimately familiar with Eurovision.
I sure am.
I am not. So I'm going to learn something today.
I hope so, Avi. It's high time. Eurovision is the Olympic of pop. So all the Euros, all the people from Europe, like myself, we are very passionate about it. And it is a lot of fun. It's kind of silly, very over the top, but a lot of fun. And competitive. It's very serious.
And there's voting, right?
Yes. So there's voting, there's politics, there's love, there's passion, there's glam, there's glitter.
Costumes?
Oh, yes.
Great costumes?
Okay. Ooh, yes.
I'm excited to hear more about Eurovision. That's the last segment today after we talk about the bird flu. If you have questions, by the way, about the avian flu, because there's a lot of information floating around, and it is hard to sort through all of it, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email your questions to studio2@whyy.org. But before we get to all of that, we want to sort of add a coda to a story that we talked about yesterday. Philadelphia officials cleared out what remained of an encampment in Kensington this morning. Now, this comes as Mayor Sherelle Parker promises to clean up the neighborhood, which has been at the epicenter of the opioid crisis.
And the cleanup also came on the heels of a rally last night where Mayor Parker, again being in Kensington, promised more resources and really a lasting investment in all kinds of services for the neighborhood. Joining us now to talk more is Billy Penn reporter Mayor Rindy, who was in Kensington bright and early this morning. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So, Mayor, what happened this morning, and how did it compare to what we expected to happen?
Well, we were told that police and health workers would be out there around 8 this morning clearing a couple blocks of Kensington Avenue, sort of the epicenter of the open-air drug market down there, and helping people who are using drugs, who are homeless, who are camped out there in tents, access services, and also remove them and clear the blocks for the benefit of the residents, essentially. So when I got there at 7:30, it was already over. The police had gotten there probably around 6 a.m. And a lot of people had left already because they knew that the police were coming. So later we were told that maybe a dozen people were helped. So the place had sort of already cleared out in the preceding weeks and days, and they kind of finished that up today.
And there was a press conference this morning. What did officials say about how everything went and how the effort kind of went down?
Yeah, Adam Gere, who's the chief public safety director for the city, spoke for just a couple minutes, a few minutes. And he declared this, you know, a success, essentially, that the mayor's vision of improving the neighborhood was working out, that people had been helped, had been provided with services. He seemed to have gotten his story a little. He didn't have all the details. He thought that health workers had started showing up at 8 o'clock and started helping people. By 8 o'clock, I can guarantee you there was no one left there. So still some crossed wires there between the police and the public health people. But he said, yeah, this is the beginning of an effort that will continue, and they'll move on to other streets and so on.
Yeah, let's get a clip. This is Chief Public Safety Director Adam Gere at that aforementioned press conference this morning.
If anyone comes, attempts to set up any tents, any structures, within 72 hours, if we're notified, so we're asking, all of our folks are on the lookout for that, but we're asking also if the community sees any of this stuff, let us know. Those can be taken down immediately without having to do another encampment resolution.
So what he's saying is vigilance, I guess, moving forward, Mayor. Is that what's expected? Do we know what the next steps are here?
Yeah, it's a little unclear because they're characterizing this as a one-time encampment resolution. At the same time, the police and the mayor have this long-term, multi-phase plan to clean up and revitalize the neighborhood. So it's a little unclear. Is this the first part of that? He kind of suggested it is, that they'll be continuing to do outreach in the coming days so that people don't just all descend back on Kensington Avenue. I talked to some people in the neighborhood. A lot of them were very skeptical that this would lead to any lasting change. I talked to a man named Brandon who said he was a longtime resident and a longtime drug user, and yeah, he was definitely among the skeptics.
I think that everyone's just going to migrate somewhere else. They did Operation Sunrise like 15 years ago, and everyone just migrated somewhere else. I don't think it's going to change anything. They could block this off all they want. They're just going to move right around.
And I definitely say I walked around the neighborhood a little bit, and there were plenty of people using drugs and living on the street, just within, even around the corner, just steps away from where the police were. So you could see that why people are skeptical.
Did you hear from anybody who was relieved that, you know, there were some more resources and this cleanup effort was being brought to the neighborhood?
Oh, definitely. I think people who live in the neighborhood, who operate businesses, are desperately want to see some change there. I spoke, for example, to a man named Alex who lives nearby and runs a barbershop right on Kensington Avenue. And he was definitely saying that something needs to happen.
There can actually finally be some change going on around here. And I know we need it because families are tired, and the mental health for the area dealing with this, seeing this on a constant basis, it's not good for the children.
As we get you ready to go here, Mayor, what are you looking for next?
Again, the big question is this the beginning of something bigger, or is it a one-time effort? And if it is something bigger, how big is it? How long will it last? How large geographically will it stretch? When you walk around that neighborhood, you can see it's an immense problem. There are hundreds of people living down there. There's huge amounts of trash and needles on the street and all that. So it's a huge project they're taking on. It'll be interesting to see how it goes.
And, I mean, there is also, I guess, the issue of you're pushing the problem from one place to the next is a fear that a lot of people have expressed. And we, even on WHYY, we heard from people all the way in Pottstown who are concerned that homeless people are now being brought potentially to their neighborhoods, right? So there definitely is this worry, are we putting a Band-Aid on the situation or are we trying to fix the situation?
Yeah, people who have been there for a while and have watched the situation say you really need to solve the community's problems, poverty, education, unemployment, all the whole nexus of things that lead to a situation like what Kensington is experiencing. So there's some skepticism that just a police response isn't gonna solve it, really.
Thank you so much for the time and for all of your efforts today. That is Billy Penn reporter, Mayor Rindy.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. Let's turn to some other news. Traffic deaths went up in 2023, according to PennDOT. Deadly crashes on Pennsylvania roadways increased, I guess, somewhat slightly, but there were 36 more deaths, which is not good news. Mm-hmm. And PennDOT has a message for drivers. It's a crash, not an accident. And what they are trying to point to is that driver behavior is the leading factor in 83% of crashes.
Yeah, I'd heard that linguistic sort of nuance pointed out to me before by advocates, but I was surprised to see PennDOT, you know, furthering that message, the idea that we should call them crashes and not accidents. This increase, Mike, that you pointed to, mm-hmm. it comes on the heels of a small decrease. And I think there was some hope from 2020, you know, from 21 to 22 that maybe we had hit the post-pandemic peak. Because, you know, in the first couple of years of the pandemic, traffic fatalities did go up. And I think there was some hope that it was maybe starting to trend down. And now, instead, we're kind of riding the roller coaster back up. So it's certainly some disappointing news in terms of traffic fatalities here in Pennsylvania.
Drunk driving crashes did go down
right.
from 2022. So that is good news. But I think a big factor here is absolutely distracted driving. And if you are in traffic or if you are on a bicycle, you will notice that about 95% of people are on their phones while driving. And I don't mean talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are looking at the screen. So this is perhaps not a huge surprise.
We talked about linguistics for a moment there, Mikan.
Yes, you said the word.
I said the word because yes. I was setting up this transition to the next story.
That was a long pitch.
That was a long one. This story caught my eye.
Okay.
A study done by a doctoral candidate at Temple named Daniel Guarin. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm getting his name right.
Mm-hmm.
Looked at signs
mm-hmm.
in three different parts of Philadelphia. And what languages those signs were written in over the course of about 3 years.
Yeah. Oh.
And the idea, this is a type of study. It's called a linguistic landscapes study. And it kind of gives you a sense of how language and, in a sense, how ethnicity is changing in a place over time. And he looked at a few different places in Philly. One of them is called the Golden Block, El Bloque de Oro. This is like the heart of what has historically been the Puerto Rican community
mm-hmm.
in North Philadelphia, and found there that Spanish signs are becoming less common in that area.
Hmm.
And it kind of makes sense because the folks living there have been there for a while, and then sort of the kids and the grandkids perhaps, you know, drift away from Spanish and toward English. But then in other parts of the city, like in South Philadelphia, for instance, a dramatic increase in the number of signs written in Spanish. And that's where there's a newer immigrant population, a lot of folks from Mexico. So it's just an interesting way to sort of keep tabs, right, on how the city is changing and how people are moving around the city without having to wait for like a census every 10 years. So I just thought it was an interesting way to do that type of research. I'd never heard of this before.
No.
Linguistic landscapes study.
Nope, never heard of it. But I will pay more attention now because also, to be honest, like I haven't really paid attention to where the signs are and what languages they are in. But Philadelphia's immigrant population has also grown,
yeah.
according to new Pew data from the state of the city. And a lot of people are saying, generally speaking, whatever economic health the city has had over the past couple of years and the fact that our population levels have not dropped dramatically is thanks to immigration.
Yeah, I believe what the Pew data said, the percentage of foreign-born Philadelphians is as high as it's been since the 40s, I believe. I'm doing that one out
yes.
of memory, but it hasn't been this high in a long, long time, and you're right.
Right.
It's totally tied into the city's future. I don't know if there are probably not a lot of signs in German, though, around the city.
have not spotted them.
Well, but keep an eye out.
I will. 200 years ago, signs in German everywhere.
That's true. Probably German language newspapers and everything.
Yes, they were. All right, so one more thing that is of great interest here is that Philadelphia's...
Come on, it is of great interest. I'm very interested
interest,
in
yes.
this story.
Philadelphia's ultimate frisbee team, the Philadelphia Phoenix, the mascot for this team, has a new name thanks
okay.
to the internet. This was reported by our colleagues at Billy Penn, Nick Kiriuki. And so the team crowdsourced from Twitter
mm-hmm.
and people could vote. So they had final four names were... Oh, what
Scorch.
Was it? Scorch. Yep.
Elvis.
Sorry. Elvis.
Blaze.
Birdie McBirdface. So,
so those are the four options.
Yes.
Scorch, Elvis, Blaze, and Birdie McBirdface.
And the winner is?
What do you think it's going to be?
I don't know.
Is the internet.
This is the internet. Birdie McBirdface.
It is Birdie McBirdface. That is the new name of the mascot for Philadelphia's ultimate frisbee team, the Philadelphia Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know? Have you played ultimate frisbee? Have you ever thrown the disc
around?
I have
not. No, I have had a frisbee in my hand, but I have not competed.
It's a pretty entertaining sport, I have
it
to
is.
Say.
It is.
So they chose Birdie McBirdface. It's actually kind of a wink and a nod to an old internet joke where they were trying to name this research vessel in the UK, and they did a similar poll, and people voted for Bodie McBoatface.
Oh.
So Birdie McBirdface is a tribute, a shout-out to Bodie McBoatface.
Yes.
But in the UK example, they decided, I believe, not to go with Bodie McBoatface.
I would think not, yes.
but in this case, they are going to go with
Birdie
McBirdface. And before we end this segment, we just want to talk about something that happened last night.
Yep. I think part of the reason why I'm here today.
Part of the reason why you're here today.
Yes.
There's a big gala, festival, celebration at Temple last night honoring media luminaries with temple roots, temple connections. Mm-hmm. The main honoree was Quinta Brunson.
Yes.
But in my mind, the main honoree was the great Cherry Gregg. And it was very, very cool, I have to say. Cherry was like a star of the evening. She's in their now Alumni Hall of Fame. This is the Lou Klein Alumni in the Media Awards. So at a recognition of all of her accomplishments. And she had this to say.
Being a journalist and a true teller, telling the stories of those often unheard or ignored, making people the center of every story, that is what I believe in and what I will continue to do in my work at WHYY and with my wonderful team with Studio 2.
All right. Yay, that is wonderful.
Isn't that cool?
Congratulations. We are going to wrap up this segment.
Yes,
right?
We are.
But stay tuned because coming up, we'll talk about all things bird flu and what we need to know. We have two great experts lined up, so stay with us here.
And give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. Get your questions in now.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Mike and Scott in for Cherry Gregg today. There is mounting concern about the spread of bird flu in the United States, and that's because the H5N1 virus has now gone well beyond birds. Avian flu has been found in foxes, raccoons, seals, and now dairy cows for the first time. The viral jump to cows is what has really alarmed scientists. And although only one farm worker has contracted the flu so far, some are wondering if this outbreak could become a pandemic.
So to get a handle on the bird flu and why it's spreading so widely and the potential for human-to-human transmission, we are joined by two experts. Angela Rasmussen is a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Troy Sutton is an assistant professor of veterinary and biomedical sciences at Penn State. Troy, welcome to Studio 2.
Great. Glad to be here.
And if you in the audience have a question about the bird flu, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And Troy, I was wondering if we could start with you. Could you give us a bit of a, I guess, state of the union? Where are we now with this virus and how far it has spread?
So, as you mentioned, the virus has been introduced into cows. Mm-hmm. And right now, it's been detected in 9 states. And so, you know, there is some evidence that it may be a little bit more widespread than that. But the USDA is sort of trying to get a handle on that. And there's an effort to really detect and identify this virus in any sick cows that show up.
And why are cows of such acute concern?
So historically, cows have not had a lot of influenza in them, and so that was a real shift. There are reports in the literature of cows previously being infected with influenza A, but it's fairly rare. And so to see a virus in a new species and now transmitting in that species causes concern for flu scientists. And then as well, humans have a lot more exposure to dairy cattle than they do, for example, wild birds or seals. And so there's concern that more people might be exposed to these viruses.
And how are farmers monitoring cows for the virus? How does the virus show up?
So right now, all of the evidence points to this being what we call a single introduction. So the virus was introduced from wild birds into cows on a particular farm or in a particular state, and then it has spread from that farm to other states. So Can you rephrase that?
Yes. I just wanted to know how they are monitoring cows for the virus. Like, how is the testing being done? Is there enough testing capacity?
So, the way that this is detected is that dairy cattle, they have a drop in milk production and they show sort of a mild illness. And then farmers then report that to the USDA or to their local veterinary office, and they come out and do an inspection. The testing is on a case-by-case basis, to my knowledge.
I want to bring in Angela Rasmussen now. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, studio2@whyy.org is our email talking about the avian flu. Angela, what would need to happen for this virus to move to humans and for human-to-human transmission to begin? Like, do we understand what types of mutations would allow that?
Well, we understand some of it, and we're getting towards some of those answers. So one sort of low-hanging fruit is to look at the distribution of what's called the receptor. For influenza A viruses, this is a molecule, a sugar molecule that decorates the outside of different proteins called sialic acid. And there's a couple different configurations of this sialic acid. There's a type that is more likely to bind and allow entry of the avian viruses, including this H5 virus. There's another type of sialic acid that's just a little bit different in terms of how it's shaped, that is usually involved in binding seasonal flu. So we have done, some of my colleagues have done a study looking at the distribution of the different types of sialic acid in cows, and they do have both types of sialic acid. So we do know that cows could potentially be susceptible to both H5, which we know they're susceptible to now, as well as other seasonal influenza viruses, and that creates opportunities for these viruses potentially to mix up and to adapt to using both kinds of receptors. Another situation that could allow for this to happen is transmission back and forth between cows and birds that would theoretically allow selection of viruses that can use both types of receptors as well. But that's where it kind of ends in terms of what we know. So yeah, we don't know the exact mutations that would allow this this virus to transmit efficiently from human to human, even though it does appear that now it's transmitting efficiently from cow to cow. Some of this also has to do actually with the circumstances. So one thing is that we don't know the exact mechanism by which this flu is transmitting from cow to cow. We think it's in the milk, or it is in the milk. We think it's related to transportation based on the epidemiological data, but we don't actually know by what route it is getting back and forth between the cows in. We also know that it has spilled over into birds and other mammals, and we don't know what route that is occurring by either. So trying to understand whether or not this virus is going to become capable of human-to-human transmission very easily really depends on us answering some of those outstanding questions.
Yeah, I think everyone kind of wants you to give like a percentage chance of this happening. But what I kind of hear you saying is, well, we really don't have the data, or we don't have the information we would need to make that type of assessment. Is that fair?
That's completely fair.
And what makes the most sense at this moment in time in terms of prevention, in terms of keeping an eye on things and being ready should something like this start to happen?
Well, I think for starters, we really need to do more of the keeping an eye on things. So as Troy said, the testing is currently happening on a case-by-case basis. USDA has prescribed new rules for testing even asymptomatic cows, which can certainly be infected at this point, prior to them being transported across state lines, or if they do show signs of illness. We need to do more of that. We need to do more surveillance in cows, including asymptomatic cows. We need, I think, to do testing of beef cattle as well as dairy cows, since, as far as I know anyways, really no surveillance has been done on that. We also need to be doing probably serology, which is to look for antibodies to H5, which suggests a prior infection. And we need to be doing that both in cows as well as in dairy workers and people who are in close contact with those cows. And then finally, we also need to be testing those people. None of this has taken place so far, at least not widely. And this information is, I think, really critical to filling some of those knowledge gaps, as well as, of course, research to understand mechanisms of transmission and things that I was talking about earlier as well.
So we're not doing any of the things that we should be doing. That does sound a little bit troubling. I want to bring in a question here from one of our listeners. This is from Lou, and I'll pose it to you, Troy Sutton. Lou asks, why is avian flu popping up right now? Hasn't it been around for a long time? And it's been around for decades, right, Troy?
So avian flu has been around for a long time. There are certain forms of avian flu that exist in wild birds at all times. This virus is new in that it originated in Asia and has been carried around the world by migratory birds. And then it has become introduced or become what we call endemic in non-migratory birds in Europe and North America and really worldwide. And so it's a new strain, and this strain in particular, these viruses, have a history of causing mammalian infections and some human infections and making humans quite sick. And so this has sort of elevated our concern about these viruses because of their prior history.
Is it possible that other strains of the avian flu have spread to other species before, but we didn't catch it because we weren't doing that kind of testing?
So there are a lot of spillover events of avian influenza viruses into different animals.
Mm-hmm.
That happens on a fairly regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Whether those viruses infect that animal and then continue to transmit in that new species is a somewhat rare event. And so that, again, is why we are concerned about bovine flu, because it is a new species and the virus is transmitting in cows.
Yeah. And the symptoms in cows seem to be pretty mild. So are we fairly confident that cows are getting tested? Because, I mean, it seems like in some cases you could even not notice it.
So there is evidence that there is asymptomatic infections in cows. We need to do more testing of cows to really get a grip on how widespread the virus is and how many animals are asymptomatic versus how many animals are symptomatic.
Angela Rasmussen, I want to bring you back in the conversation. What about vaccines? And now I'm talking about vaccines for domesticated animals, but also humans. Like, what is the landscape for vaccines right now, and should we be ramping up production?
So that's a really complicated question that doesn't have any easy answers, unfortunately. So the short answer is, yes, we do have vaccines, and we've been making influenza vaccines for decades now. We know how to do it very well. We have made vaccines for H5, but the question is to should we be producing more of them, and who should get them is the part of this question that's complicated. So previously, for some avian influenza outbreaks in China, they have used vaccination on poultry, and that has reduced both the incidence of those outbreaks as well as spillover into humans for people who are handling those birds. So at least in that case, vaccinating the birds actually reduced disease overall for both birds and people. Now, where this gets tricky is the fact that these influenza vaccines are not what we call sterilizing. They don't completely prevent and block infection. So a vaccinated animal or a vaccinated person could still potentially be infected. They're just not going to get as sick, which is actually an effective vaccine, because vaccines are really intended to prevent disease, not to prevent infection. However, the concern is that the viruses would keep circulating potentially in birds or in any other vaccinated host, and that they would be able to continue adapting potentially to either evade immunity elicited by the vaccine or just to continue mutating and adapting to that host. And then you wouldn't necessarily be able to identify outbreaks as easily either, because you wouldn't have the animals actually getting sick. So that's why there's a lot of, there has been a lot of debate as to whether poultry producers should be vaccinating their flocks. It hasn't happened in the U.S. as far as I know. Some places in Europe are actually trying this. It remains to be seen as to whether there's going to be a recommendation to vaccinate cows. I do personally think that it would be prudent at this point, though, to potentially vaccinate dairy workers or people who are in close contact with cows to protect them from what is potentially a lethal disease.
And here's a comment from Mancy, who wonders, will there be mass culling of cattle similar to the killing of chickens during COVID-19? Troy, can you try to address that? Will we see cattle killed as a precautionary measure to stop the spread of the virus?
So right now, I would say no. It does not look like that'll be in a strategy to control the virus. When these viruses get into poultry farms are culled because the virus by itself will likely kill most of the birds on that farm. Mm-hmm. And so with cows, this is different. You have a virus that isn't causing a lethal disease in cows. And the economics are slightly different as well. So I don't think that's going to be a strategy that will be employed.
Hmm. And Angela, question for you. You know, we have heard that this virus has been found in milk products. People are sometimes worried about eggs. How is there any danger in those products for humans, or does that the potential, rare as it may be, for human infection only come from sort of a more direct contact with an infected animal?
So again, we still don't know the exact mechanisms of transmission, but some data came out last week from the USDA and some from academic collaborators that showed that pasteurization is actually effective at inactivating the virus. So even though people, I think, have been very confused about this because they hear that fragments of the virus's genetic material has been found in commercial milk, that's understandably worrying, but those fragments are just pieces of the viral genome from inactivated viruses that have been rendered non-infectious due to the pasteurization process. So for now, as long as you're drinking pasteurized milk, pasteurized eggs are also available. You shouldn't have anything to worry about in terms of the food safety.
I want to note that a few listeners have mentioned that this outbreak, for them, indicates that it's time to shift toward a plant-based diet. And I guess the question I'll ask off of that for you, Troy Sutton, is the way that animals are raised for food here in the U.S. and around the world, does that increase the risk of something like this becoming a pandemic?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, I know it's a tough one, but even if you could just break off a chunk of it, because a lot of listeners are bringing it up right now.
Yeah. So the events that lead to a pandemic, one of the most significant events is humans being exposed to animals that are infected with these viruses. And so so really that's the major limiting factor, or one of the major limiting factors, and whether or not agricultural practices definitely directly contribute to that, it's hard to say. The reverse is true. In parts of Asia where they have live bird markets and people get infected with avian influenza viruses when they visit these bird markets, when they close those bird markets, the human infections go down. So it depends a lot on the species you're working in. It depends a lot on the cultural practices around it. But it is not a one-to-one relationship where agricultural practices are creating pandemics.
And what are you hearing from your colleagues, Troy, from people who perhaps are in the farming community? I don't know if you're frequently in touch with them, but I'm sort of wondering, what is the backroom chatter at this moment in time? What are people most concerned about from where you sit?
It's a lot of what Angela mentioned. You know, understanding how this virus is transmitted between cows is important to us. Getting a good grip on the risk that this virus poses to humans, does it bind to the sialic acids that Angela recommended? Those are really the things that we're really trying to get a firm grip on. How does this virus behave in our models of humans?
Angela, we're getting ready to wrap up, just about a minute left, but, you know, you look at viruses all the time, and I'm sure there's like an alarm scale somewhere in your head where, you know, on one end, this is not that concerning. It's the type of stuff that circulates all the time. We don't have to overreact. And on the other end, there's, you know, probably the early days of COVID-19. I mean, where are we in that spectrum right now as you try to assess the risk?
For me, I would say that this is, if you want to compare it to like the terror alert level, this is like orange for me. This is, you know, heightened concern. There are things that we need to be doing right now that Troy just alluded to, including understanding mechanisms of transmission, getting a better idea about the extent of this outbreak in cows in the U.S. One thing I'm doing with my colleagues here is trying to assess whether or not this has gotten into Canadian cattle. And people are doing that all over the world. And that work really needs to happen right now. But we're not at red yet. Mm. And that, I think, is really important to note. It is up to us if we're going to take the right steps or not to get on top of this before we go from orange to red.
Well, that is a good place to leave it. Thank you so much. That was Angela Rasmussen, virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Angela, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you also heard from Troy Sutton, assistant professor of veterinary and biomedical sciences at Penn State University. Thank you, Troy. And we will be back on Studio.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Two.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, in for Avi Wolfman-Arendt today.
All right.
Mike, I'm guessing that the Eurovision Song Contest was a pretty big part of your life when you were growing up in Germany?
Yes.
I assume correctly?
Yes.
You watched what, every year?
Yeah, every year. It was a big deal. You watched it on the television and then you were like, boo.
who were you booing?
Everybody else who was not Germany, of course. So yeah, it was.
Did Germany ever win?
I'm sure at some point. Yeah,
I don't know.
It's a lot. It's a long time ago, probably. I don't remember. But yeah, it was always really intense. There are judges. They have to speak all these languages. They have to go to French and speak in French and in English. At least that's how it used to be. And it was just hilarious.
Well, apparently, Netflix released a movie about Eurovision called The Fire Saga, and it's getting Americans into the spectacle.
Yes, and it is a spectacle. Mm-hmm. I call it the Olympics of pop, but it's also just like really cheesy, really campy, really big costumes. Sometimes you watch it and you're like, is this satire or is this real? And then you're like, no, this is real.
This is real.
And the contest is a stepping stone for some very big names. I'm sure even you, Avi, have heard of ABBA. Good.
Yeah,
very good. Celine Dion.
I didn't know she was involved in this, but of course, yes. I do know Celine Dion, and I also know that the Eurovision finals are taking place in Sweden this year.
Woohoo!
And our German-American colleague, Andreas Kopes, has been meticulously following the musical drama and has this look at the contest that launched so many careers.
Dublin, April 30th, 1988. A 22-year-old, fairly unknown Canadian singer represents Switzerland in the 33rd annual Eurovision Song Contest. That is the unmistakable voice of Celine Dion. She became a worldwide phenomenon after winning the European Music Competition.
That really launched her internationally. You know, she was known in Canada before that, but after Eurovision, she took off.
William Lee Adams is the founder of the website WeWeBlocks and author of Wild Dances, My Queer and Curious Journey to Eurovision. He's covered the competition for years and is a big deal in the world of the song contest. I asked Adams if he could think of other big names who got a jump start at Eurovision.
Julio Iglesias represented Spain. Olivia Newton-John, the British-Australian singer, she represented the UK. More recently, Måneskin from Italy. They were nominated for Best New Act at the Grammy Awards. You know, they've had global hits. They've toured the United States. And they were born of Eurovision.
The list of stars is long, and so is the history of the contest. The first Eurovision competition took place in 1956 in Lugano, Switzerland. The goal was to unite a Europe formerly divided by World War II with music.
Refrain, couleur du ciel, parfum de mes 20 ans. Jarada.
Switzerland won that first contest in the mid-50s with the song Refrain. But Eurovision was more than an exercise in peace and love. It was a technological experiment, says Adams.
This was the first time that people across borders were watching the same show at the same time. And then on Monday morning after the weekend, they'd all be talking about the same thing. You know, there are very few things in the world that do that. Maybe the World Cup, the Olympics. So Eurovision holds a really special place.
Overseeing all of this is the European Broadcasting Union, a collaborative of international public broadcasters that spans beyond Europe. So, since 1956, nations around the globe have sent singers in hopes of winning the trophy.
It's a pan-European song contest in which countries field a 3-minute song. And these are original songs. This is not a karaoke contest where people cover Whitney Houston and Mariah. They write the songs, they perform the songs, and they often do so with over-the-top, elaborate staging. I like to say it's American Idol meets figure skating meets Star Spangled Booty, you know, the Super Bowl halftime show in the U.S.
Now, a quick recap. You don't have to be a European country to participate. The public broadcaster only has to be a member of the EBU and can then apply to enter the Eurovision contest. That's how countries like Morocco, Australia, or Israel have competed in the event. And like any competition, there's some fine print. Rules abound, but here's the most important one.
Vous ne pouvez pas voter pour votre propre pays.
Vous ne pouvez pas voter pour votre propre pays.
Don't forget, you cannot vote for your own country. It's Eurovision tradition.
And it's another old tradition. You cannot vote for your own country.
Every year, the contest takes Europe by storm. But it barely registers here in the U.S. Since our PBS isn't a member of the European Broadcasting Union, we don't participate. America has never become as Eurovision mad as other countries around the world.
The United States is such a hegemonic cultural power. It's movies, it's music, it's actors. They're all over the world already. Whereas in Europe, if you're from tiny Malta, tiny Moldova, people don't really know your talent. They don't know your creatives. And so I guess in the United States, there's never been a need to be in a competition like Eurovision. And there have been efforts to promote the popularity of Eurovision in the US, but it was a niche audience, we can say this. It was on an LGBT network, and that should be celebrated. That's fantastic. But Eurovision is for everyone. And I think maybe the struggle initially was that heterosexual viewers who weren't familiar with it thought, oh, this is maybe something only for gay people, and so it's not a space for us. But that's not the case. I think Will Ferrell's Netflix movie, Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, helped give people a taster. People are like, what is this? And they typically asked, is it actually real? You know, truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. And people saw that movie and thought it was based on nothing. But I can tell you firsthand, it's based on reality.
And one of the many characters in the seemingly unreal world of Eurovision is superstar Celine Dion. In a 2013 interview on British TV, she said her experience in the contest decades prior felt like being secretariat in the Kentucky Derby.
I felt like a horse. And let me elaborate on that.
Please do.
You can bet on the artist that you want the country to win. So my husband, who's a gambler, bet on me. A lot of money.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was a horse and I needed to race. Wow. I really needed to win that race. Did you see me?
Yeah.
Nerves, I was like this. I looked like a horse and I felt like a horse.
While Celine galloped to victory in 1988, Australia's Dami Im got silver in 2016 with her song Sound of Silence.
Calling, calling,
Standing on the big stage performing her song, Dami said,
I don't know, I feel like I was in like another world by then. Like in my head, I was just like trying to focus. And it was like the night of the Olympics, what I'd been training for all my life kind of thing. That's what it felt like. So when I went on stage, I felt a huge cheer coming from the audience, which was really encouraging, you know, because you're so nervous and there's so much tension in your body, but you just go, this is happening. This is amazing. Like it just gives you this positive vibe and this atmosphere just comes over you. I felt like.
Her time on stage went by in a flash, but her career has seen long-lasting effects thanks to Eurovision.
That's when I changed everybody or started to question who I work with, you know, who I make music with, who I work with in the label, and all those things, those changes came from Eurovision. And seeing so many fans from Eurovision that support me, you know, my song charting and just getting that love, it just made me feel like, hey, I don't have to put up with people that don't support me, that, you know, as in the industry, people that I don't feel comfortable that have my back, you know?
Damim and William Lee Adams both grew up outside of continental Europe. Adams is Vietnamese-American and was raised in small-town Georgia, and Dami is Korean-Australian. So I wanted to know how they found their way into the corniest, cheesiest, and campiest show in the world.
You know, I had watched it growing up with my friends. So I remember, you know, like going to sleepovers and friends that were really into it had it on and I'd go, oh my gosh, what is happening on TV? That doesn't look normal. But it was all very exciting. It was fun to watch. That's my memory of it.
For Adams, it was a man who pulled him away from the States. He remembers his introduction to Eurovision like this.
When I moved to the UK, my boyfriend at the time, now my husband, he said, we've got to go to this Eurovision party. You know, you're going to love it. It's like beauty pageants mixed with musical competition. And I was like, what is this? You know, I've seen American Idol. I don't need this. But then I fell in love because we had a drag queen from Ukraine dressed in tinfoil.
Now, he is referencing Verka Sedutchka in 2007 with the song Dancing Lasha Tumbai.
Narrowly losing to a Serbian lesbian of Roma descent.
And that is Maria Serifovic with the song Molitva.
It was all these identities duking it out on stage, and they were so talented, emotional, funny. I was hooked from the first minute.
While the Eurovision Song Contest has come to be an emblem of multiculturalism and diversity, it's a non-political competition. However, global events have a way of injecting politics into the event. In 2022, Russia was banned after invading Ukraine. This year, they are increasing demands the EBU ban Israel from participating after the outbreak of the war in Gaza. Here's Adams again.
The EBU has said that the analogy with Russia and Israel doesn't really work. They say that, again, this is a competition between broadcasters, and they point out that Israel's broadcaster has often been at odds with the government on many issues, and that if you look in the recent history, Israel actually shut down its state broadcaster at one point in the past decade. So the EBU doesn't view this as a parallel situation.
Again, politics seems to be unavoidable, but at its heart, the contest is still something meant to be light and to bring people together. And speaking of unity, who will fans rally around to push to victory in this year's Eurovision? Here's what Dami had to say.
Yeah, I think this year is exciting because there seems to be lots of songs in different languages, in the native languages. I really like the Spanish entry.
She's talking about the Spanish entry Zora by the singer Nebulosa.
It's just something so beautiful and special about it. And, you know, the language thing, I think, plays into it as well.
The grand final of this year's Eurovision Song Contest will take place in Malmö, Sweden on May 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern. For Studio 2, I'm European correspondent Andreas Coates.
Well, that sounds like fun. And that's it for our show today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler. Welcome back, Paige, and Andreas Copes. Special thanks to Matt Gillum for helping to produce that piece you just heard. Diana Martinez is our engineer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Mike and Scott. Come watch Eurovision with me at the German Society on Saturday, May 11th. Woohoo! It'll be a big party. Studio 2 will be back tomorrow.